This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. We have everything you need to update your window treatments with Window Images blinds and shades. We carry vinyl, aluminum, and faux wood blinds, cellular shades, and more. Plus, get them trimmed to width in-store for free. Also, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Melissa, I heard a vicious, vicious rumor that...
About who?
About you.
Oh, it's probably true. Did you read it on the bathroom wall at the truck stop?
I did
not. Oh, because those are all true.
So word on the street is you cooked a meal on the stove.
I did. Like a meal.
Like a meal. Not a microwave. Your microwave wasn't involved.
No.
Or Grubhub wasn't involved.
No. I know. Grubhub sent me an email that same day and they were like, we miss you. Here's 40% off. Like they were worried about me.
You're like, it's been 36 hours, Grubhub.
Literally, but they're concerned.
Wow. What did you make?
I made chicken Alfredo, like with real chicken. Like
that's
it was
legit.
Chicken that I cut into, not a real chicken. Well, it was a real chicken, but like chicken tenderloins that I cut into pieces.
They weren't like breaded chicken tenders?
No.
Really?
I did it all myself. I'm fucking Gordon Ramsay. Bam. No, that's Emeril.
That's Emeril. So just stay out of the kitchen. Like,
damn it.
Did you use canned Alfredo?
I used jar Alfredo.
You did not make dinner. Get out of here with your homemade
dinner. But I had raw chicken and I cooked it in the air fryer. That counts.
All right. I'll let it slide. Only because it's probably the first meal you've cooked since, I don't know, ever.
Just call me Gordon Emeril.
Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
What is happening, crime crew? Welcome back to Murder Unscripted, episode 70, to be exact. And I know that because we're keeping track of episode numbers now.
And because that's your age.
Wow. That's messed up, man. Well, if you are listening to this, you have found the most insightful and engaging true crime podcast on the internet today. And I will stand by that comment. That one I'll stand by. I'm your host, longtime true crime producer, Ed Hydock, along with my bestie, a woman who knows more about these crimes than the criminals themselves, Melissa Spivey.
That's valid. And hey.
All right, well, we are knee-deep in our September block that we are calling The Case That Haunts Me. My God, have we covered some horrific crimes, and unfortunately today is probably worse than all of them combined, so get ready.
Yeah, that's like the understatement of the century, but okay. Yeah. Well, before though you go and like depress everyone listening, I'm going to do a little housekeeping. Not real housekeeping, because I don't do that, yeah, but on the show.
It's up there with cooking.
Exactly. If you like what you're hearing from Murder Unscripted, please take 30 seconds to leave us a review. And as always, don't forget to like, subscribe, and share the episode with your friends or anyone you think would enjoy it. I heard a podcast the other day say to share with your friends, and I'm like, I don't have any.
Yeah, who are you going to share that with? Me? And I already...
Yeah, and my dogs, but they can't, they don't have thumbs to click on the podcast icon, so...
Well, my question is, like, what if they only like half the show? Like, what if they just like listening to me, but not you? So, like, do you leave half a review? Do you...
That would never happen, so...
Take the average and leave 3 stars?
3 stars, we'll take it.
Well, I also want to mention that before we kind of get going here, that this case was put together by our brand spanking new research producer, Pam Beeler. And Pam did a fantastic job with this, and we are thrilled to have her on board because she's a writer by trade. And so you know that the scripts you're going to get are going to be well-written, they're formatted properly, they contain proper English and proper spelling.
Better than mine.
Better than all of yours, yeah. So, but she's also a true crime fanatic. Like, we've been discussing Delphi since the moment I met her, so she's got, like, her finger on the pulse of the true crime world.
It's true.
Well, today we are heading to Phoenix, Arizona, 1993, and our case begins in a quiet neighborhood where a single knock on the door began a series of events so horrific that even seasoned detectives say they were changed forever. This is the story of the Luna family murders.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about crimes that leave investigators haunted, we're not using that word lightly. This case is probably one of the most violent and cruel cases that we've really ever covered on this show, and I'm going to go ahead and give a trigger warning now because there is a murder of a 5-year-old. There's also torture and sexual violence involved. Yeah. And actually, this is probably a case not many people have heard of, and I would say that's due to the violence and, like, utter depravity of it. And you and I have talked about this before, but I feel like this is one of those cases that's just deemed too much for TV.
Absolutely. Well, for the reasons that you mentioned, like, a network would never touch it. And if they did, it would be incredibly watered down, you know, and that's why you won't find a whole lot of coverage on this case. Retired Phoenix police detectives have admitted that even decades later, the images of what they encountered inside the Luna home are absolutely impossible to forget. But before we get into the aftermath and kind of the lifelong burden carried by those officers, we need to talk carefully about what actually happened that day. Because I feel like it's only in understanding the step-by-step choices of the perpetrator in this case, a guy named Richard Jerf, the cold and calculated decisions that he made that day are the reason that this case lingers for so many involved.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily looking forward to it, but I think we should probably get into it.
Yeah, buckle up. That's all I gotta say. And I have a connection at the end of this case that is gonna, your head's gonna spin.
Ooh. So
get ready for that. I'm saving that for you.
Yeah, I don't even know. You said that before we started. You're like, this is going to blow your mind, and I don't even know what it is.
It is. Well, you can't know yet, so yikes. You will. Well, it is Tuesday, September 14th, 1993, and the Luna family lives in this modest one-story home in Phoenix, Arizona. And on the surface, they're like so many hardworking families in the area. You have Patricia and Albert Luna, both in their 40s, and they're raising children, 21-year-old Albert Jr., 18-year-old Rochelle, and 5-year-old Damien. And because there's not much out there on this case, I wanted to take the opportunity to set the bar by dropping some deep-ass research on y'all, because this way, if it's ever covered in the future, we can say that we were the model, because you know how, like, people will use other pods or other shows as their, like, blueprint?
Mm-hmm.
So if some of this info turns up, I'm going to be awfully suspicious that it didn't come from us. So Albert Sr. we're talking about was a Vietnam vet, and he was a member of the American Legion. So both he and Patricia Patsy Luna, that's what she went by, they were children of Arizona's copper towns. They were raised in the shadows of the smelters and mines that defined life in Morenci and Clifton, Arizona. So Albert followed a familiar path when he took a job at the Phelps Dodge acid plant right after high school, and he married Patsy soon after. But when the violent miner strike of the early 80s erupted, Albert's loyalty to the union cost him everything. He refused to cross the picket line, so they replaced him. And that meant the young couple had to spend the next year searching for work in their respective hometowns. They absolutely loathed big city life, but their dreams of like finding a job in the mining industry in their little town were slipping away given what had happened. So they reluctantly leave behind the only world they know, and they move to Phoenix, Arizona, where Albert Sr. gets a job as a lab tech and Patricia as a custodian at the Byron Berry School District. So in the city, the Lunas really tried to live carefully. They were extremely cautious of the dangers that came with their new surroundings. Albert made a point about staying inside at night, He was convinced that the home was the safest place to be, given what was going on in the area at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they even resisted letting their daughter, Rochelle, so she worked at a grocery store and she worked some late hours, and they were pushing her to get daytime shifts. But she was saving up for college, so she was kind of between a rock and a hard place with them because she needed the money, but they were kind of pushing her to not be out that late at night.
Look at the yogurt shop girls. They were working late at night. Like, it's, you want to say don't be afraid of the world, but how can you not be?
Yeah. I mean, it's, there are so many dangers out there. Brenda just left to go on a walk. And I just, even then, it's like just having to do all these stories all the time. We know what happens if someone goes out for a walk. Like, you just never know. So you need to say, be careful.
Yeah.
Well, the Luna's lives were quiet. They were cautious and they were centered on family. But the sanctuary that they had worked so hard to protect became the very place where tragedy found them. And before we dive into that tragedy, I want to tell you about the couple's three kids. We just talked about the couple themselves, but Albert Jr., Damien, and Rochelle, who I just briefly mentioned. So Rochelle was a popular and gregarious senior at Trevor Brown High School. She ran track, and as I said, she was working at a local grocery store. But by all accounts, everyone at school had nothing but positive things to say about this girl. 21-year-old Albert Jr., he worked at the local Walmart and was described as a good kid by neighbors, but he ran with a rough crowd sometimes. There were some quotes in some newspapers that I found a little troubling, and we're going to get into because there's a deeper discussion here. But Damien, so the five-year-old, he was described as happy and friendly, typical little boy, probably loved his Ninja Turtles, Jurassic Park action figures. And I was trying to think back to this time, and I was a little older than Damien was in 93, but those early 90s were something, weren't they?
Oh, yeah.
I can just picture that time period like it was yesterday, and I know for you, the 90s are pretty much every day.
Literally every day. I try my hardest. Well, if you think about it, I was about 5 in 93. I guess I was 5 or 6. So, I mean,
so what were you doing?
Watching Rugrats. I still do. Watching Doug.
Is that what was odd back then? I don't even know.
I think so, yeah. I mean, that's what I remember watching as a kid.
I was interested in girls by that point, so cartoons were back burner.
Okay, says the man who talked last week about watching wrestling and cartoons on Saturday mornings.
Yeah, when I was 5. Well, on this warm September morning, Patricia is at home with Damien, and it's basically an ordinary day. She's doing chores, routines, the ho-hum of suburban life. And Patricia was described as the type of mom who would welcome anyone in, make you a plate, and treat you like family.
I know what's coming, and it's like, it's such a sad state of the world when, like, unfortunately, I feel like that sort of kindness that Patsy had, it's kind of part of what is going to make her and the rest of the family so vulnerable, because kindness can open doors. Literally.
Literally. Exactly. Yeah. Well, how many people have we covered who become victims doing something completely innocuous or helping other people or just some kind of like completely innocent task? You know, and everything changes the morning of September 14th with the sound of a knock at the door, which you just mentioned. And the person knocking is 23-year-old Richard Jerf. So before I get into this god-awful incident, a little background on Richard Jerf. So he was born in 1969 and grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. And he had this reputation for being, I guess we'll just call him a loner. But he wasn't like the mysterious broody kind, though, that you see in movies. He was like the guy that you actively avoid at parties because he's in the corner just creeping and lurking.
Creeping, yeah.
Yes. So to give you a snapshot of this guy, newspapers reported that Jerf had a boa constrictor as a pet. And he had this dummy hanging from a noose in his apartment. Like, I found that also in an old article. And they were like, it was like Halloween every day at his place. It was just off-putting.
Yeah, that's not exactly the kind of guy you bring home to mom.
No. Mm-mm. So Richard Jerf and Albert Luna Jr., so the son, had actually known each other from work. They didn't work together at the Walmart. He actually worked at the Safeway, which is where Albert Jr. worked before he worked at Walmart. So they were kind of previous co-workers, but they'd become friends over the years. And full disclosure, so Albert Jr., the son, had been known to get into some hot water with things like theft and burglary, and he'd even done some time in jail. And I absolutely hate to bring this up because I think this is what has me so torn on this case, and I never want to speak ill about somebody who had gone through what this kid went through and has to live with. But the bottom line is he did some incredibly stupid shit in his young life.
Yeah.
So between September of 1991 and January of 1992, Albert Jr. was working as a janitor for ABCO Supermarkets. And during that time, he had stolen 60 cases of beer, 90 cartons of cigarettes, 96 bottles of liquor, and some money. And all in all, when you combine all of those things, it totaled $8,100.
Wow.
And there was one occasion where he stole a key to a safe and he hid out in the store until it closed, at which point he swiped $2,100 from the safe and he was arrested while trying to escape through the air vents on the roof of a strip mall, because it was it said it was over of like a hair Holiday Hair or a hair cuttery or something, but he didn't work there, so he must have tried to get out the top of this roof, and they called, like,
wow,
just some dumb behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The thing was, though, like, Richard Jerf, his former colleague, he knew all about this. So when Jerf's apartment was burglarized in January of 1993, Albert Jr. was the first person that he suspected. And to be honest, I don't know if he was wrong.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I couldn't find, like, I've heard about this case and I wasn't sure if he definitely had done it or not.
I'm not sure either. And I was really digging for this information. Mm-hmm. The only thing I could find was that he was heavily suspected of it and questioned by police, but never arrested. And yeah. It went so far as Jerf actually called Patricia, Patsy, and said, is there any of the following things which he was missing? So I'll tell you this. So what was stolen from Jerf's place?
Jerf. Yeah.
Yes. Electronics like a TV and VCR, stereo equipment, car alarm, and an AK-47 assault rifle. So he reported this to the Glendale police, but months passed and no action was taken. So he was obviously frustrated. So Jerf starts calling Patsy to say, hey, are any of these things, a TV, a VCR, car alarm, stereo equipment, is any of that in your house? He was like, because obviously Albert said it wasn't me, I didn't do it. But the hunch was that he did.
Yeah.
So obviously this had him enraged. He was frustrated that the police didn't do anything about it. And this anger was festering. He was absolutely stewing about this. And the more he thought about it, the angrier he got. And this obsession, unfortunately, turned into a plan of revenge. And as I mentioned, he was kind of a loner. So think introverted, cerebral, meaning like he was not the kind of guy that was just going to fly off the handle and lash out impulsively.
Which makes him more terrifying. Those people are always the scariest.
Hell yeah, they are. Like, it makes him methodical. And that's so what he did is he waited, he plotted. And I know it's weird to talk about the motive before the crime actually happens. So you're like, what are you even talking about? But I wanted everyone to understand what led up to the events that we're about to talk about, because this is a luxury I don't normally have on television shows. You have to build the suspense. Where here, I think the lead up and the understanding of what happened is going to show you this horrific outcome, what it was caused by.
It's like he nurtured this toxic little seed of hatred until, like, it bloomed into something deadly. You know what I mean?
That's exactly what he did. And it's over something so stupid. So again, it's late on the morning of September 14th when Jerf shows up to the Luna's home at 7202 West Monte Vista Street with a plan, as well as a 9mm Beretta, a knife, some handcuffs, rope, tape, latex gloves, and a vase of artificial flowers as a ruse to basically get in the door. And the ironic thing is, this is not the first case I've covered where fake flowers were used to get a victim to answer the door and let their guard down. But I will save that story because now we have a tie-in. So bottom line is, though, it worked. And Patsy answered the door to accept the flowers, and Jerf immediately pushes his way inside.
Yeah, because that's what good people do. Like, they assume the best in everyone. And I feel like that's exactly what Jerf exploited.
Exactly right. And investigators later said that what chills them the most is not just the brutality of what happened, but the coldness behind it. I mean, this wasn't a man who snapped by any means. Like, this wasn't done in the heat of the moment. It was planned. It was callous. It was calculated, and it was deliberate.
Yeah. And I think that's why this case gets so under people's skin, because he woke up that day. He, you know, he grabbed that duct tape, the knockoff flowers, and he literally acted like this was a scheduled errand. Like, okay, today's the day I'm going to kill a family.
It's so freaking terrifying, isn't it? Like, he just proceeds. Yeah. So he goes in this house and he immediately proceeds to tie up Patricia Luna using the rope and tape that he brought. And mind you, the 5-year-old is just running around at this point. So Damien really doesn't know what's going on. And get this, at one point, he removes her restraints and, I assume at gunpoint, told her to load some of the family's belongings into the family car. And I'm guessing this was to make it look like a burglary gone wrong or something, but he had the victims do it themselves. Like, talk about insult to injury.
Ugh.
And some of the stuff was similar to the things that had been stolen from him, which maybe there's some little nugget of motivation in there too, like a stereo, a phone, some VHS tapes, but also some change and a money clip that held some food stamps. So I don't know if this guy was acting out because you stole this from me, now I'm going to take it from you. So after loading up the family vehicle with all these stolen goods, Jerf proceeds to tie Patsy back up with rope and black electrical tape, and this time Damien too. So he got his hands on the kid and did it to him too.
Oh, I feel like poor little Damien had to have been so scared.
What you're going to hear, and you know the story, but our listeners, what Damien is going to experience is like nothing you would wish on your worst enemy. So yeah, he ties them both to separate kitchen chairs and turns them so that they're facing each other, pressing her about where Albert Jr. is. And just a reminder that this is a family that had no beef with this guy. Like, I'm not even positive they knew him. This was Albert Jr.'s friend, and he was fixated on Albert Jr., who wasn't even there. And he just unloads that rage on anybody in that house. And I don't know if that was just anger taking over or if that was his plan the whole time, was to get back at him for stealing stuff. He's going to kill his whole family. Ugh. It's absolutely infuriating. It's also so tragic. And the motive matters because it explains both the planning and the cruelty. It shows that this wasn't random. And appellate courts would later spell out that he went there for retaliation over that January burglary. And what he did inside met Arizona's especially heinous, cruel, or depraved aggravator later on. So it does come up in the court process.
I feel like cases with findings like that, like, they're definitely the kind that haunt detectives for the rest of their careers. Like what we've been talking about this whole block. Like my one with Darlene Krashock, that was so heinous
and cruel.
That
was sick.
Mm-hmm. And I know you hate trigger warnings, but this seems like a good time for another quick one before we keep going. Lots of violence, yes. Sexual violence, lots of stuff coming up. Fast forward if you need to.
Yes, you know my feelings. I've made that very clear about trigger warnings. Like, you're watching a show about murder. It's a big trigger warning. We should just name the show Trigger Warning. That's actually
show name. Anyway. Copyright. Trademark.
Anyway, this is like above and beyond, though. And I feel like we can't remind listeners enough this time because it does get rough. Okay, so timeline. So late morning, gets in the house with the fake flowers. Mid-afternoon, he's still inside the house controlling Patsy and Damien, waiting for more family members to arrive. So it's around 3 p.m. when 18-year-old Rochelle comes home, I assume from school. I wasn't able to find that out, but that's my guess.
Yeah, she just comes home and has like no idea what she's walking into. Like, imagine getting home from work and walking into this.
So Rochelle walks in the door and Jerf immediately forces her into the bedroom. He gags her with tissue paper and the tape that he had brought, and he ties her wrist to it was a daybed. So there he uses a knife to viciously cut her clothes off and sexually assault her, all while mom and little brother can still hear what's happening from the kitchen. Like, they have to listen to all of this.
That's gotta be a parent's worst nightmare.
Nightmare isn't even the word. It's beyond a nightmare, because Jerf then kills Rochelle by stabbing her in the chest several times and slitting her throat. It was such a violent attack. So she had several non-fatal wounds to the back of her head too. And at some point she had thrown up underneath her gag and aspirated vomit. So I don't know. Her earring too was ripped completely through the earlobe.
Oh.
So yeah. So Jerf then goes back downstairs and taunts Patricia, telling her he just raped and slaughtered her daughter.
This is agony by design.
He's not even close to done. So about 4 o'clock, Dad, Albert Luna Sr., gets home from work. And just like he did with Rochelle, Jerf bum rushes Dad at the door, handcuffs him, forces him to crawl to the master bedroom and get face down on the bed. And there he beats him in the head with an aluminum baseball bat. So after he cracks Albert over the head and blood splatters all over the bedroom, Jerf removes the cuffs and walks away, believing he's kind of finished him off. So he goes back in the kitchen and basically tells Patricia, guess what I just did to your husband now too.
This guy, and I don't want to compare killers, but like, this guy is bad. Like, pure, he's just like taunting poor Patsy now.
And for what?
Right.
For some stereo equipment? It's just, and the worst part is he's just getting warmed up. So after killing Albert, Jerf tries to kill 5-year-old Damien, first by twisting his, twisting his neck, quote unquote, like in the movies. So basically, like, you see in some of these old martial arts movies, Steven Seagal movies, they come up behind and just one of those. It doesn't work, though. So what he does is he strips the plastic sheath off of a lamp cord, and he tapes the wire around the boy's leg, and he flips the light switch and electrocutes this poor kid. That is how far this guy's sadism goes. And I can guarantee you that he watched this family suffer and enjoyed every second of it. And all of this revenge for someone who wasn't even there. Like, he was angry at Albert Jr. This has nothing to do with them.
I feel like this is like a mob killing or something when they hurt the family members and not the person they're mad at. Like, because that almost hurts you more.
Absolutely. Ugh. Well, and you're going to see that this has not mob ties, but other suspicions too. So I'm going to get into that in a second. So back in the master bedroom, Albert Sr. is hemorrhaging blood from this attack, but he's not dead. I mean, this guy was a fighter. He was determined to save his family. So he frees himself, stumbles to the kitchen, and he grabs a pocket knife and he goes after Jerf. And he was able to stab him he stabbed him once in the lower left side, but Jerf eventually overpowered him. And there's a struggle. Jerf eventually stabs Albert through his arm and into his torso. Mm. And then he just pulls out a 9mm and fires 6 times. And Albert falls dead right at the feet of his wife and son.
Okay, Albert Sr., that's a dad. Like, what a badass. I know it didn't end well, but holy shit, what a badass.
That's what you do, though. You saw your family in that situation, every last breath is spent trying to save them. It's just what you do as a man.
That's a dad.
Well, then Jerf turns to Patsy and says, do you want to watch your kid die, or do you want your kid to watch you die? And essentially shoots them both in the head at close range.
I do remember reading or hearing, this was years ago, that he killed Patsy first, the mom. Maybe. I'm not sure if that's true, but I do vaguely remember hearing that.
I mean, does it matter, though?
No, I'm just saying, like, to be that poor child, I cannot imagine how scary that has to be.
And the only saving grace is that I assume they went quick, but not after all this abuse, like... But I'm hoping that the gunshot, at least just, it was over quickly. And the shock from watching his mom die, if that's true, was over in a second. But good God. So before Jerf leaves, he gets this idea. He's going to start a fire. So first he splashes gasoline on the bodies and around the house and lights a fuse cord. He had this red fuse cord that he brought with him. Like picture a stick of dynamite and the fuse. He had rolls of this stuff. So this was pre-planned. He was going to use this to light a fire in the house. But as soon as this fuse is lit, he immediately puts it out because he looks out the window and he sees and hears children playing. So he's like, I can't just start a fire and walk out of this house or I'm going to be seen immediately.
Yeah.
Eventually, though, a couple minutes later, the coast is clear. So what he does is he puts this greasy pizza box on the stove, turns on a couple burners, and there's a rag in one of them too, but like it doesn't ignite. So he tried his best, but left the house at that point, got in the family's car, the one that he loaded up with all that stuff, and then he drove it to the Westridge Mall, and he parked it there. Then he got in his own car and drove away. So this was all part of his plan. He drove to the mall, somehow got then to the family. I'm not sure. I should have looked up how far away the mall is. Like, I assume he walked, but then he took the family's car back to retrieve his car, and off he went.
Wow.
So after this, he meets up with his girlfriend, Emily Boswell. And I'm going to mention her name. I wasn't gonna, but I'm going to, and I'll explain why later.
No, I think you should. And I think I know why, and I think that you should.
When he sees her, he's got this gaping wound to his side from Albert Sr. Good for him. Because even in death, Albert Sr. essentially solves this case. And you're going to hear about it. So what he says to her, though, is he's like, I was at the mall and... there was a robbery when I went out to my car and somebody stabbed me. So she's obviously concerned, I guess, at this point, and she rushed him to St. Joseph's Hospital for treatment. So at this point, the Luna house, like the crime scene, is just sitting quiet. And Albert Jr. was still at Walmart working. He had an evening shift and he'd been calling home a couple times and no one was answering, though, which someone was always there to answer and they weren't. So he got a little worried and he doesn't get home till about 11:45. And when Albert Jr. walks in, there's his mom, his little brother, taped to kitchen chair, sitting upright, dead. His dad's on the floor, a bloody mess. So he's obviously completely shocked by all of this. And he runs out and calls police from his girlfriend's house.
Imagine being the patrol officers and like first responders who step into that kitchen. I'm sure they didn't know what was going on. We've talked about this. You don't get a ton of information. they walk in and to see that a specific, like, especially with a 5-year-old, like, that kind of shit, how do you not see that forever when you close your eyes?
I don't know. And like, everybody listening, seriously, take a minute. It's like, stop and think about this, because we live in a world right now where we are so sterilized to violence. Like, another day, another crime. Like, am I wrong with that?
Mm-mm.
But seriously, like, put yourself in Albert Jr.'s shoes for just a single second. Like, think about the imagery and pretend that's your loved ones. Like, this should mess you up. And it's not. It's not messing people up these days to hear these crime stories. And that's, it's supposed to make you sick to your stomach. But this is exactly what this absolute monster planned to do to a family of human beings when he went to the house that day. So I'm going to touch on this neighborhood for a second, because witnesses told the Arizona Republic that there were more police cars and fire trucks than they'd ever seen in one place. And the immediate thought was this was gang related. I found so many articles that when you see something like this, when you see a family slaughtered and fires and all these different weapons, and like, you have to think that someone was sending a message.
Right.
So the extreme violence played a role in that theory, but also because this neighborhood wasn't the nicest. And at the time, they had a lot of problems with gang violence that was well noted in newspaper articles. And the other theory, and this came from one of Albert Jr.'s friends, was he had been having problems lately with people smashing the windows of his car and shooting them out even. So in the past, I think it was 3 different occasions over the past couple months, he had these windows busted out. So could this have been gang activity too, or was this someone out to get Albert Jr.? Well, it would not take long to find out the answer, and they learned it was the latter. Because the very next day, September 15th, Jerf tells his girlfriend what he actually did, like, confesses in detail. And he describes the murders and chillingly says the blood dripping from Patsy's wound was really awesome. Like, you should have been there. Which is why I want to drag that woman's name through the mud, too. Because the way he said that makes me think, like, that she would have been a willing participant, maybe if she was home, or that they had talked about doing this and she was all for it. It was almost like he was bragging about it.
Right. And the fact that she didn't just up and call police right then and there.
Yeah.
Like, or make an excuse to run out and get some milk and go to the police or something.
Something. Well, over the next few days, Jerf is discharged from the hospital, and he had his buddy rent a motel room before also confessing to him, bragging to even more friends. And eventually those confessions make their way back to police. And there's mixed reports here, because I've heard it was a local pastor who heard of the confession from one of, like, Jerf's friends that he bragged to. But then I also heard that Jerf told a friend who, and the friend told his parents, and the parents were the ones that called police. So I don't know which is true, but bottom line is this guy likes to run his mouth.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, that shows no remorse. If you're actively bragging about what you did, you don't feel bad about it. There's a difference between bragging and confessing, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. With no remorse. I mean, but that's what these assholes do. Like, they are all driven by ego, power, control, being in charge. And that they wear these crimes like badges of honor, and their mouth always gets them caught every time.
Always. And actually, I'm skipping ahead a little, but come my first case in October, running their mouth is what gets them caught.
It never fails. They can't shut up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on September 18th, Phoenix detectives execute a search warrant on this motel room that we just talked about, on Jerf's car, and also his apartment. And they recover items that he brought to the Luna home, and even the fake flowers, as well as the property that he stole. And I'm going to list this property for you. So the police found handcuffs, a 9mm Beretta, a stereo CD player, 2 VCR units, a U.S. West caller ID unit, artificial flowers, and a vase, watches, Rochelle's charm necklace, a cardboard knife sheath, Patsy's car keys, a telephone, loose change, food stamps, and a red fuse cord. And at the time of the arrest, police actually found a handcuff key and a newspaper with articles about the crime in his possession. And Richard Jerf is arrested that very day.
Well, yeah, and I feel like by the time the Phoenix PD got him, like, they're not dealing with a whodunit. This guy has basically solved the case for them by running his mouth to anyone who would listen.
Yes, and, like, he did.
You know, they have the crime scene, and they've got the recovered weapons and restraints. They've got stolen property. They've got his mouth. Like, what more do you need? You did this to yourself, bro.
Absolutely. And I feel like that's another reason that TV won't touch this, because there's no mystery. And I mean, you can't just fill an hour of television time with blood and guts and gore and expect people to stay tuned in. It's like, it's uncomfortable. Nobody wants to see it, you know? So the state decides to file charges, 4 counts of first-degree murder, kidnapping, armed robbery, burglary, sexual assault, attempted murder, pretty much every charge they have. And are you ready to have your mind blown? Because 3 days after Jerf's arrest, the body of 17-year-old Melanie Burness is found mutilated and floating in a Phoenix canal just a couple miles from Luna's home, and the case of the Phoenix Canal Killer begins. And we know that would not be solved for another 20-plus years.
Wow. You know what? When I was, like, thinking about this crime, I remembered I had heard it, and I knew it was in Phoenix, and I found myself wondering if it was kind of around the same time as either Angela and or Melanie, but I completely forgot to look into it. That is wild. And you know what's even crazier, too? Today, when we're recording, is September 15th.
Like, isn't that
the
insane?
Day that he confessed, like, we did not plan this. I just realized were recording. That's crazy. Insane.
I had a mention earlier in the script that, like, this was also on the heels. It was like an offhand mention on the heels of the Phoenix Canal killings. But then when I saw the date, I found in a single article, it was like 12 days of violence in Phoenix. And in the same article, Melanie Burness and the Luna family are mentioned together.
Wow.
So crazy.
Well, and they're both such violent crimes and seemingly out of nowhere that I can't even imagine. The PD's probably like, what the hell is happening?
But think about the people, too. Can you imagine the fear gripping this city?
Oh, no.
Body parts are showing up, floating torsos. The Luna family slaughtered like they thought it was gang or mob, like you said, mafia. Like, what is going on in Phoenix in 93?
That is wild. Not a place I would want to be.
No.
Kind of off subject, and I don't know if you're going to get into this, but didn't Jerf try to kill himself when he was in jail?
He did. So actually, several weeks after the murders, he slits his wrist with the metal from a musical Halloween card. I didn't have a lot of details on it, but I assume he had one of those cards that you open it up and it plays a song, and then he was able to disassemble that somehow and use it to try and kill himself. But I'm happy to report that he lived so he can sit and rot in prison.
Good.
So, but here's where the case gets kind of unusual. So Jerf decides he wants to be his own lawyer, and we all know how that works out. But the crazy part is, like, despite his suicide attempt, the court deems him competent to represent himself. It seems off to me, but whatever, I'm glad.
You know what? That's such a disaster, and it's also my favorite thing ever. Like, when these assholes think they're smarter than the judge and the lawyers, and, like, I'm going to go ahead and say it. If Bundy couldn't do it, you can't do it. Let this be your PSA for the day.
Because Bundy was a lawyer for the most part. He went to law school.
And then I feel like by doing this, it turns into such a publicity stunt. Like, it makes a courtroom into a sideshow.
It absolutely does. Like, hello, Daryl Brooks. Hello, Lori Vallow.
Ugh.
You know? So, but it's always super entertaining to me to watch, because I love when they televise trials where people represent themselves because they look so stupid. When people say that they want to represent themselves, like in those pretrial hearings, I've seen judges say, like, are you sure? Because we definitely recommend you getting a lawyer. So Jerf walks into that courtroom basically wearing two hats. He's the defendant and his own attorney. And he ends up pleading guilty to all 4 murders in exchange for all the other charges, including the sexual assault on Rochelle, that they're dropped.
I feel like being his own attorney and, like, wanting to plead guilty, it's like a control thing. It's like his control issues from the murders carried straight into the courtroom.
Yeah, well, he thought taking a plea deal would mean the death penalty's off the table, like that his life would be spared. And I assume he just didn't want the jury to hear all these heinous details. Mm-hmm. But here's the kicker. The plea deal didn't take the death penalty off the table. So 7 weeks later, Jerf is like, you know what? Is that lawyer still available? That whole lawyer thing we were talking about? Can I still get one of those? So they eventually give him some representation. But the judge had to go through Arizona's aggregating factors because, plea deal or not, that's what happened here. And boy, they were not hard to find in this case, because we're talking multiple murders off the bat. That's the big one. Child victim, murder for financial gain, an especially heinous, cruel, and depraved conduct. I mean, it's all over. It's writings on the wall.
He literally had a full house of these aggravating factors.
Absolutely he did. And at the sentencing hearing, the public learned about Jerf's upbringing. So let's present some of these statements on why poor Jerfy was so messed up and why he did this. Jerf explains how he was basically abandoned at age 6 by his mother, whose new husband, quote unquote, didn't like kids. Yeah. He was raised by his father, who was cold but not abusive necessarily. However, he was teased in school about his weight and spent a lot of time alone. Welcome to the fucking club.
So was everybody.
Yeah. So Albert Jr. testified, and I can't even imagine how hard that would have been for him to do. Mm. Like, I get that he did some dumb shit, but at the same time, he still saw what he saw, and it's still his family. So I'll bet you he regretted every single one of those decisions at that very moment. But he testified that in the months leading up to the murder, he'd received some phone calls from someone calling herself Stephanie, asking him to meet her, but he never took the bait. And Stephanie, it was learned, was Jerf's girlfriend, who was helping Jerf try to lure Albert out, presumably to be confronted by Jerf himself. And that's why Emily can be dragged through the mud.
Yeah.
Because this girl also testified about helping Jerf move the Luna's car to a parking lot after he came home with it. But then, astoundingly, she wasn't charged with any crime. So riddle me that. I can't figure that out.
I don't get that either.
And you know what struck me in the records? So the judge emphasized not just that he killed four people, but how he did it. Mm-hmm. Like the prolonged mental anguish, especially with Patsy having to watch her daughter and husband be attacked for her own execution. And also her son right sitting right in front of her tied to a chair, 5-year-old. Like, that is psychological torture, and it met the state's bar for cruelty.
I was just going to say, that's why I get so pissed off when people are like, well, the death penalty is cruel and unusual. So is this shit. How are you going to tell me it's not? And you think that putting someone to sleep with an IV in their arm is cruel and unusual compared to this shit?
It doesn't get worse than what he did. So if there are people out there who still don't think the death penalty should be a thing, see Richard Jerf in the encyclopedia.
If he does this to your family, then you can come and tell me you don't want the death penalty.
Absolutely.
Hit me up. I'll give you my digits. Like
100%. So in May of 1996, Richard Jerf is sentenced to death times 4. So he got 4 death sentences, essentially. And he's been on Arizona's death row ever since. His appeals have focused mostly on like the technicalities of everything, like whether or not he should have even been allowed to represent himself, whether his plea deal was truly voluntary, or if these deaths were especially cruel. And it's like, cry me a river, you piece of shit. Yes, they're cruel.
I just want to bring up what he said in court when they gave him the 4 death penalty sentences. His response out loud in front of the court and the victim's family was, you can only kill me once.
Well, there you go. That tells you everything you need to know about him. He even had the balls to say that Rochelle's murder wasn't especially cruel because maybe she vomited behind her gag because it was hot out that day. Or maybe she ate a big meal beforehand. So that's a glimpse into what we're talking about with this guy. Thankfully, none of his appeals have gotten traction because, frankly, they're ridiculous. And the Arizona Supreme Court did uphold his sentence, and even the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the case. So this guy's out of options.
Yeah, I mean, which just tells you how strong the record is against him. Like, there's no, oh, this could be the wrong guy. That's not an argument here. There's no shaky forensics. Like, it's his words, his actions, and his planning that he laid out in this minute-by-minute detail.
All because he just had to tell people about it. Like, I really do think that if he would have just shut up and went home, he probably would have got away with this, and some gang would have been, because some gang members were questioned in this. So he could have got away with it. And interestingly, neighbors reported in newspapers that Albert Jr. was seen wearing gang colors. And the thought was that he was trying to be recruited into this gang, but he said no, and that's why his windows were being shot out. So I think that's where the gang tie theory came into play. But at the same time, cops, once they arrested this guy, they kind of scolded the public in the newspapers. They were like, see where all this gang talk, see how dangerous that can be? Because that's where we were heading. We were so focused on this. If this guy wouldn't have confessed, we may not have gotten
him. Wow.
So it does leave us with this kind of stark contrast where the legal side is pretty clean cut and airtight, but the human side, like the investigators, the prosecutors, even the neighbors that lived next to this house when it all happened, they knew this family and heard the details. Like, they carry around the memory of a house where one family's ordinary Tuesday turned into an absolute nightmare.
Well, yeah, and I kind of remember reading about, like, even the medical examiner being shook by this case. And I feel like for a medical examiner, who that's literally your job to see this kind of stuff, like, all day, every day, for them to be messed up about this, that really says something. And not in a good way.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because we covered the crime, the capture, the courtroom, all those things. But the part that lingers is the part that gives this case shadows. It's the repercussions. Like, I want to mention that one of the most heartbreaking pieces of this, the surviving son, Albert Jr., the regret that he had to feel that the second he walked in and saw his parents lying there, and especially after Jerf confesses and he realizes this was my fault. Like, and to be the only one who came out of it unscathed, talk about a death sentence. This kid's got to live with that. I think if there's a lesson here, it should be that your actions have consequences. Mm-hmm. This kid had a penchant for stealing. He had a penchant for doing bad things. And I don't know if this was part of that gang initiation thing or what, but why he was taking all this money, the liquor, like the volume he was stealing stuff in makes me think it was for a bigger purpose, which maybe that's where this gang theory gets traction, because you're stealing 90 cases of cartons of cigarettes and all that. Like, that can't be for personal use. So I imagine this was for others.
Right.
I can't imagine that he ever thought his mistakes would kind of lead to this. And it was just one man's vendetta against the family. And it sucks, because a huge part of me feels awful for him.
To me, that's almost the worst part. Like, thinking if I was him, having that guilt on me, that would be what would haunt me the most almost. You know what I mean by that?
I agree. Like, I completely agree. Like, the picture of what he saw that day has to be, how do you ever get that? If someone says, your mom, Patty, how does your brain not go to that first?
How could you watch a TV show and see, like, the same glasses that the lead character's drinking out of? And, oh my God, those are the glasses that were in your kitchen. And, you know, like, I feel like that never gets out of your brain.
It is cemented there.
Yeah. Well, I definitely feel like this case qualified for the case that haunts me. And like, it's like, I feel like when a murder happens in a community, especially something this extreme, it's like the crime scene never really closes. The tape comes down, the courts move on, but like the psychological crime scene, it just stays open forever in that. It's got to in that neighborhood.
It absolutely does. And I know for a fact the investigators still carry that weight, because in an interview with 12 News earlier this year, Francesca Garcia, so she was in training at the time, back in 93, and she said, quote, that scene is as vivid in my mind as it was 30 years ago, end quote, which we just talked about. Like, you think it's vivid in her mind. Imagine Albert Jr.
I started in May of 1973.
And after 20 years with the Phoenix Police Department, in September of 1993, Francesca Garcia transferred to the homicide unit.
Shortly after that was when I received a call out to go to the home in Maryvale of the Luna family.
She was still in training.
That scene is as vivid in my mind today as it was over 30 years ago.
Inside, four family members were found tortured and murdered. Patricia and Albert Luna, and two of their kids, 18-year-old Rochelle and 5-year-old Damien.
I was assigned to work with Detective Steve Lewis.
It's the worst thing I have ever seen.
Retired Phoenix Police Detective Steve Lewis remembers where each family member was and the evil they faced before they died.
Even the medical examiner that did most of the autopsies, I was there for all four. And she cried.
The community was terrified as the search for the suspect was on.
You only get one crack at that scene.
In a matter of days, they got their guy.
Did you ever interview Richard Jerf?
I did interview him, and the only thing he would say to us was, we read him his rights, and he said, my girlfriend had nothing to do with this.
Jerf ultimately pled guilty and was sentenced to death for each of the four murders. But that was in 1996. He's now exhausted all appeals, and the Maricopa County attorney says he could be executed next if the attorney general issues a warrant.
It's never going to bring anybody back. That's not what it's about. But it's to serve as justice for what happened to the family.
For these retired detectives, whose investigative work got this mass murderer off the streets, they believe it's long overdue.
Let me say this. If anyone ever deserved the death penalty and to be executed for what he did, it's Richard Jerf, because he's a monster.
I mean, well put. And that's why this case keeps like resurfacing in Arizona, especially every time there's a debate about the death penalty, all somebody has to say is Richard Jerf. Like,
yeah.
He, not because he's become like the symbol of a wrongful conviction, he's the opposite. Like, he's the case people point to when they say, if not him, then who? You don't get worse than this.
It's chilling, but true. And this is like literally the textbook definition of what lawyers mean by especially cruel and heinous and depraved.
Now that I'm thinking about it, like, this case was not super well known. How many more cases are this bad that investigators and crime scene techs and death investigators are dealing with that we don't know about?
Well, as far as case updates go, as of today, Richard Kenneth Jerf has been sitting on Arizona's death row since 1995, basically, so nearly 30 years. But he won't be sitting much longer because in less than a month, assuming everything goes according to plans, he will be put to death by lethal injection, which is not nearly a punishment for what he did. But
no,
I don't know. His appeals have been heard, rejected pretty much at every level. So in August, a death warrant was issued. And shortly after that, his execution date was scheduled for October 17th. So I'll absolutely make sure your party invitation is in the mail.
Seriously, I generally don't pay too much attention to that kind of stuff. But this one, I'm all about. And we will definitely update everyone as soon as that vial is injected.
Yeah, absolutely. So something I just want to add here at the end. So when I was looking up articles to see, just to make sure this execution was still scheduled, I found that he had actually talked to reporters not that long ago. He basically said, like, this wasn't some kind of, like, I wasn't on drugs. I just did it. And he's like, I wish someone was there with me who could have talked me out of it. Like, I'm sad it happened, but it wasn't me. He's like, something happened to me in there. And he's like, I'm not making excuses. Like, he was very upfront about it and very forthright. I guess when you know death's imminent, you're willing to just be like, what's it matter at this point?
Yeah, what do I got to lose?
Yeah. But it was interesting to me, his mindset, because he's like, I wasn't on some kind of, he's like, I just was angry. And I went over there and it was just out of my mind and just did it. And the second it was over, I'm like, man, I wish it didn't happen, but it did. So
were you really that sorry? Because you bragged about it. So maybe not the moment it was over.
No. Well, you know what I mean? Like, it was interesting that he said I wasn't possessed. There wasn't some demon in me. He's like, I was just out of my mind. He's like, it was me. It was all me.
Yeah. So,
well, that, my friend, was the absolutely horrific, awful, tragic, everything else story of the Luna family murders. And it's a story that has become one of those kind of touchstone cases. And like you said earlier, it's one of the ones that prosecutors point to when they need to justify the death penalty. Like when someone asks, why do you still have this? Because of Richard Jerf.
Well, and the sad part is, I think that he should be put to death, but I don't think that it's going to give closure, if there is such a thing, especially for Albert Jr.
Well, especially at this point, when he's been on death row for 30 years, like, I think that would be the moment that you would say, okay, the nightmare's over, but like, he's not dead. They're not killing him. He's just sitting in jail.
No, I mean, if they do and when they do put him to death in however many days, I still don't feel like that's going to be closure. Like, it's still going to haunt the detectives. It can't erase this shit from their brain. It's still going to haunt 100%. The son, the neighbors, the detectives, and so on.
Well, and what I was saying was like the closure, like, whether he's actually dead or sentenced to death row and has just sat there, like, I feel like it's almost the same thing. Like, seeing him die is one thing, but it's like, he's on death row, you know, he's not going anywhere. So it's like, is that your justice? Was that the moment closure happened? Or would it be when he is actually not on this earth anymore? I don't know.
I don't think there's any closure for what he did.
And that's why we tell these stories, you know, it's not to sensationalize them or to like talk gore and shock you with this stuff. Like, it's to remember the victims and to try to understand the human impact, and especially to show you how violence and the aftermath can ripple through families and communities and change laws and become cornerstones of why we have certain things in our law system.
Yeah.
And while Richard Jerf chose to define his life by destruction, the Luna family, they can be remembered not just for the way they died, but for the love that they shared. I mean, they were all about family. And the saddest part is they never wanted to move to Phoenix.
Yeah. I mean, these cases we picked this month have been rough. They've haunted everyone, to put it mildly. Speaking of that, actually, this case kind of reminds me of what we're going to be talking about next week with our very special guest.
Oh, yes. Did we reveal it last week? I forget.
We did, yes, because we talked about how we have been teasing her, but we also tease her.
Yes, yeah, we do. And we actually recorded her not that long ago, and she's great. She gives a really interesting perspective on death, how it changes people.
Well, and how the things these people see do not go away at 5 o'clock when they clock out.
It doesn't for us either. And we don't even like work these scenes. We just tell stories. And like, there are things that I hear and see and read that live with me. There's
Sarah Yarborough makes me cry to this day. Like, I'm going to get teared up thinking about the dog statue. I can't even handle that episode.
No, and the fact that as we're reading it, it's slowly tying into a when did we do the canal killings? I forget when that was, but it was like, I'm reading this going, oh my God, this is the same flurry of crime at the same time. Like, Melanie Burness was the second victim. So that's it was wild. After that, but just, I think it was December of 92 is when the first victim was found. So Angela, like, this was Angela Brasso. Yeah, it was a wave of crime that, holy cow, man.
I can't imagine. Well... Mm-hmm. We hope you come back next week. After this, yeah, I understand if you don't. But no, please, you definitely don't want to miss next week. We have Shannon next week. It's going to be a really good interview.
We didn't interject a lot. We kind of let her tell her story because it's a really unique perspective.
Yeah, so definitely stay tuned for that. If you have comments about this episode, and really, how could you not? But yeah. You can hit us up on our socials, Facebook, Insta, TikTok, at Murder Unscripted. If you really want to start a conversation about this case, we can definitely do that on our Reddit page. That is a great place to have these kind of chats.
Yes, it is.
That is also at Murder Unscripted. You can hit us up on our email, murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or you can leave us a note on our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
That's it.
Well, that is all we have for you. We will see you next week. And until then, remember to be safe. Stay hydrated. And of course, we always want you to remember that perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
But they may show up at your door with a dollar store flower bouquet. So remember that.
And you are better than that dollar store. You deserve more.
You do love the good dollar store.
I do love the Dollar Tree. Damn it.
Dollar 25 store.
Oh, rip off.
Adios.
Bye.
Well, to
at Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,